Welcome to the call today, everyone. This is going to be a really great conference call, a lesson about when, why, how to hire staff to help you make a profit with your law firm. I know that some people on the call have firms that are already doing over $1 million and you already have a staff. And I've been getting your emails with some great questions, and your questions are primarily around how do you do a better job of screening staff so you don't accidentally hire crazy people. And some of your questions are about how to make more of a profit with your staff and things like that. And I also know that there are people on the call, because I've gotten your emails also, to say you don't have a staff. And some people were even asking, should I even be on the call because I don't have a staff? And, you know, when I get a staff, I hope that you'll do another conference call like this again. And I hope that I made it clear to you, if that's you, that the time to learn about this subject is before you need to hire a staff. You know, you don't want to be caught in an emergency, and that's the first time you ever think to read the instructions on the fire extinguisher. You want to know what's going on before you get to the point where you need it. So if you already have a staff, you're going to learn more about how to get more productivity from them on today's call. You're going to learn more about how to make more profit with them from today's call. You're also going to learn some things about what to do when you're replacing staff, you know, when you have to hire more staff to make that process easier, more efficient, less scary, more profitable. If you don't have any staff, then I'm especially excited for you, really. It's like one of those things where you talk to someone who's much younger than you, and you say, I wish I knew then. I wish I knew at your age what you know at your age, and you just see what a huge advantage a young person has. There's things that I'm going to be teaching you on today's call that I just wish I hadn't, that I didn't have to learn the hard way, because the hard way sucks. There's no glory in the hard way. The hard way is just expensive. It's aggravating. It's scary. It's disheartening. It's bad. I don't wish the hard way on anyone when it comes to training and hiring staff. Even if I didn't like you, I still wouldn't wish the hard way on you, because even if I wished you suffer, why should some innocent person who comes to work for you suffer because you don't know what you're doing when it comes to how to hire, train, and manage and make a profit for your staff? So I don't wish that on anyone, sincerely. We are an Inc. 5000 company. That means that Inc. magazine recognized How to Manage a Small Law Firm, and we were given an award at the most recent conference as one of the fastest growing privately held companies in the United States today. Now, I mention that because it wasn't very long ago that I was working by myself from literally, not figuratively, literally the dining room table. This whole business started from my dining room table. I had no money. I had no resources. I had no credit. I had no line of credit. I had nothing. It was all by myself that I started this business. And if there was one thing that I could have done over, that I would do over, it's that I would have learned more about how to hire and make a profit with staff sooner, and I would have hired people sooner than I did, because I waited too long. And that is a very costly mistake that you see thousands, not hundreds, not dozens, tens of thousands. There's 500,000, there's 1,500,000 lawyers in the United States today. And roughly 600,000 of us are solo and small law firm owners, or work in a solo or small law firm with five firms or five lawyers or fewer. So it's about 500,000 solo and small law firm owners in the United States today. And I promise you, if you're sitting there thinking, geez, you know, they didn't teach me anything in law school about the business of how to run a law firm. They didn't teach me about marketing. They didn't teach me about sales. They didn't teach me about how to hire, train, manage, supervise, and make a profit with my staff. And, of course, they didn't teach you anything about financial controls either. But if you're sitting there thinking that you wish they had taught you this stuff in law school, and if you have even an ounce of embarrassment, even an ounce of shame, even an ounce of insecurity of, oh, man, you know, maybe everyone else knows, but I don't know. I promise you, I've been doing this since 1999. I have worked with literally more than 10,000 solo and small law firms around the country since I was a law practice management advisor with the Florida Bar's Law Office Management Assistance Service, and in the years since, all over the country doing the CLE tour when Microsoft and LexisNexis and Firm Manager and Ruby Receptionist and Affinipay sponsored us on that national CLE speaking tour. I went all over the country meeting thousands of lawyers in 2011, 12, and 13. I promise you, you are not alone if you feel insecurity, doubt, fear, hesitation when it comes to the prospect of hiring and how to make a profit with staff. One of the big problems that lawyers have when it comes to making a profit with staff is saying the words to staff, I expect you to make a profit. That's why I'm hiring you. There's only two reasons to hire staff. Let's just keep this in mind, and you might want to write this down so you don't forget. There's only two reasons to employ anyone under any circumstances in your business, and that is, number one, they produce a profit for the business over and above what it costs to have them there. And number two, they make your life easier. If they don't make a profit for you and or make your life easier and you continue to pay them, then you're not really giving them a job. You're giving them charity. And if you want to run a charity, you know, go start a charity. Go start a foundation. Donate money. Donate your time. Volunteer. Do something. But don't use your business as a charity. Use your business as a way to make a profit for you, as a way to make a profit for your clients, and as a way to make a profit for your family. And here's kind of a novel idea, which will really, I think, set you free when you let it sink in and embrace it. It's a whole new way of thinking. Use your business as a vehicle to make a profit with your staff. Allow your staff the opportunity to use your business to advance their own career and to advance their own lives. One of the rules that we have with how to manage a small law firm, and we're up to about 28 people on payroll at this point, and we're growing. And remember, it wasn't too many years ago that I was all by myself. One of the rules that we have is, and we ask this question of our team on a regular basis when we do our reviews and sometimes even just over lunch, and we say, how have you gotten better? What have you learned? What have you learned working with us? What have you learned in the last month or in the last quarter? Because what we're looking for is we're looking for advancement. We're looking for growth. We don't want to employ someone who is as good today as they were 6 months ago. We want to employ people who are using the job that they have to get better at something. Use the job that you're doing to get better at doing the job so you can ask for a raise. And you can demand a raise, and you can be worth a raise. Use the job that you're doing now to get better so you can get a better job. That'd be great. I love it when people graduate from working with me and they're ready to go off and do something else. Use the job as an opportunity to do something in your life that makes your life better so that you value the opportunity. That's the point. The mindset of embracing the idea that your staff is supposed to use the opportunity, use the job as a way to make their life better. This is not altruism. I mean, it's a very nice thing, but it's not altruism. It is the height of capitalism, because you're ensuring that they value the opportunity and that they'll fight for the job and that they'll show up every day engaged and enrolled, because they look at it and say, wow, all of my friends, even my family, my neighbors, they come home and they hate their job and it's a dead-end job, or they don't really see a bright future with it, and they have to hide from their boss all of the things they're doing to try to have a better life outside of work. Whereas you come to work with How to Manage a Small Law Firm, and we're open about it. We're very candid. We're very open and talk to you about, what do you want to do with your life? What do you want to do with your career? What is this job helping you to work towards? And how can we structure the opportunity in a way that helps you get what you want from this job? Because we know you show up for work every day for your reasons, not for our reasons. And that's something that you should all write down also, to remember that every one of your employees, everyone on your staff, they come to work for your law firm for their reasons, not for your reasons. And until and unless you understand what their reasons are, you are really working at a huge disadvantage in terms of motivating and managing and providing leadership for them. So you've got to take the time to ask them what their reasons are. And don't be surprised if the first, you know, few times you ask that question, they swear to you that they want to work for you forever and that they love every single thing about the job and they don't ever want to go anywhere else and they don't want anything to be different and they're not using the job to try to have a better life in some way, shape, or form. Anyone who tells you that, they're scared. And it's understandable why they're scared, because most employers are very intimidated by the notion that their employees are using the opportunity as a way to have a better life, and that the employee isn't treating the job as like their A-plus, number one, most important thing in their entire world. It's not. I'm going to teach you how to have the level of confidence and security on today's call so that you truly can embrace this idea and not be intimidated or upset by it. So in preparation for the call, in preparation for the teleconference today, the reason we did this teleconference is because we were getting a lot of questions around this subject recently. We just started to notice a trend, and maybe it was my subconscious that started shooting those videos. I didn't do those videos with a plan ahead of time. I just noticed afterwards, I realized we were getting a lot of emails from prospective new members of How to Manage a Small Law Firm inquiring about whether engaging our services as their outside CEO and COO and CFO, which is what we do, would help them with this issue of how to train and make a profit with staff. We started to get, for some reason, I don't know why, maybe it was something in the air, we just started to get a whole bunch of inquiries around that subject. And then on our private members-only discussion forum, I noticed a spike, if you will, in the number of members who were seeming to be having conversations around this subject on the membership discussion forum. And then I was just kind of cruising through my YouTube channel and realized, wow, I inadvertently, accidentally shot a video series on the subject. Maybe it was just, you know, kind of vibrating in the air that made me think of it. And that's what made me do it. But that's why we decided to do the teleconference, because we were starting to get a lot of questions. And I said, you know what, let's just teach a lesson about it. That way we can share it and also have some time for Q&A. To reward you for showing up for the call and to reward you for sticking around until the end of the call, we have a very special bonus for you. Every quarter, all of our members attend a live quarterly meeting. Every quarter, it's a different topic, and we do it in a different city. We go all day Saturday and half the day Sunday, and in 2 days, you literally learn more about the subject of the meeting than you probably would learn in 5 years of banging your head against the wall with your law firm. And this is part of the secret for how we get such huge, monumental quantum leaps with our members in terms of revenues and happiness and everything else. So one of the live quarterly meetings that we did recently was all about how to hire your A-team, how to recruit and lead your A-team. And so one of the tools that we shared with our members was a worksheet. It's a one-page worksheet that you can use to very, very clearly, very simply delegate tasks to people on your team. And this worksheet is very, very effective. And we did a lesson from the stage at the live quarterly meeting to 200 plus members and their friends and family who were with them on how to use the worksheet. We took them step by step by step how to use the worksheet. They asked questions. We answered questions. So what we did was we created a special web page that I'm going to tell you about at the end of this call, where you can download that worksheet for free as my gift to you, and you can watch the video. We just had the editor chop out the portion of the live quarterly meeting where we taught about how to use the worksheet and create a little video sizzle reel around that. And so you can watch the video, which teaches you how to use the worksheet. You can download the worksheet for free. And to the extent that you make use of this worksheet, I think you will find that it is much less intimidating and much easier to delegate work, delegate tasks to people on your staff or people on your team. And to the extent you don't have anyone on your staff or anyone on your team, you do. And just stay tuned, pay attention, because I'm gonna explain to you that you really do have a staff, even if you don't have anyone else in your office with you. You still have a staff, and you'll use this worksheet and these lessons from the worksheet with great profit if you download that worksheet. The only thing that I'm going to ask you to do to get the worksheet is to answer a three-question survey. That's all. I just want to know three quick things, boom, 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 and then you get the worksheet and the instructions for how to use the worksheet with my compliments. Okay, so in preparation for this conference call, I said that I'm going to teach you five things. One, how to determine when it's the right time to hire and for which positions on your staff you need to hire first and second and third. Second, how to calculate the true cost of hiring versus not hiring staff. Three, how to go about hiring staff so you don't waste your time with a bunch of losers. Four, how to engineer each position on your team for maximum profits and minimum headaches, plus the difference between hiring staff versus building a team, because there's a big difference between hiring employees versus hiring a team. And number five, there's a big difference between employees versus team, and there's an important distinction, which I'll explain when we get to that point in the lesson. And sometimes you just want an employee. Sometimes an employee is just the right thing for a particular position. You don't always want a team. But in the cases where you want a team and need a team, and if you just have employees, you're going to be in trouble. And number five, and we're going to teach you the difference and all that in just a few minutes. And number five, how to tell your spouse or significant other that you need to hire help at home and at the office if you're going to double the revenues of your business in the next 18 months. And that came about because we were seeing a spike in discussions amongst our members. And what happens is a lot of members will engage how to manage a small law firm. And then, within about 18 months, their revenues are growing 25, 35, 50%, sometimes even more than that. And all of a sudden, they have money to hire a housekeeper. And then they have to go home and tell their husband or their wife or their kids or their family or whatever, hey, we're hiring a housekeeper. And that seems to be something that a lot of people struggle with. So I tacked that on at the end, and we'll get to that also. So here we go. One, why to have a staff? And there's three main reasons why you need to have a staff, why you want to have a staff. A, because the Marlboro man is a myth. The Marlboro man is an actor. He's not a real cowboy. He's on a photo shoot with with a generator and lights and cameras and a trailer with hot cocoa out in the snow. He's not really out there independent doing it all by himself. There is no such thing as the self-made man or the self-made woman in the business world. That is a myth. People who insist on doing everything themselves in business are people who wind up frustrated or people who wind up falling far short of their potential that they could have achieved if they had surrounded themselves with good people and engineered the positions to make a profit for themselves. Now, I understand that you go to most bar functions, you talk to a lot of attorneys, particularly the old grizzled guys, and you start talking to them about staff, and people will puff out their chest and brag about how they've never needed a staff. Well, you know, yeah, you did. You did need a staff. You just didn't know that you needed a staff, and that's why you're sitting around whining and complaining about how tough everything is, because you kept telling yourself you didn't need a staff when you did need a staff. So I'm just going to say, if you have not been growing your law firm by at least 25% in every 18-month period, and you don't yet have any employees, you know, ding, 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 guess what? Probably part of the reason you haven't been able to grow your business is because you don't have anyone working for you and you're doing things that are not the highest or best use of your time. The Marlboro Man is a myth. Don't believe the hype. Everyone who has built a successful law firm has a staff of people who they rely upon. If you want to have a successful law firm too, you're going to need to have a staff, you're going to need to have employees, you're going to need to build a team around you. You can't do it all on your own unless you don't aspire to do much. If you don't aspire to do much, then you can do it on your own. Next, why you need to have a staff. It's because you can't do it all unless you get some help, unless either, one, something has to suffer. If you think you can do it all and you're just a machine and you're just so tough and so macho and such a hard worker and so badass, you could just do it all on your own. You know what? You're going to do it on your own at the expense of something. It's going to come at the expense of your family. It's going to come at the expense of your long-term health. It's going to come at the expense of your relationships in the community. Something has to suffer if you're doing everything yourself. This is just the law of the universe. This is just physics. You just can't put 5 gallons into a 3-gallon jug. It's not going to fit. You just can't fit everything that's got to get done to build a highly successful law firm into one person's life. You need help. Next. Why to have a staff is because if you're not at your fullest potential, then how can you really be doing right by your clients? If you're not at your fullest potential, how can you be doing right by your family? If you're not at your fullest potential, how can you really be doing right by yourself? You can't. Your clients don't benefit because the saliva on the back of the stamp that mailed out the deposition came out of your mouth. The client benefits when you are at your best. Your client benefits when you are rested and relaxed and focused on the highest and best use of your energy, which is the creative space behind their case. Or even when your creativity is being used to create processes and policies and systems and procedures and checklists and templates in order to make the delivery of their services efficient through the work of other people. Your clients don't benefit when you are strung out and stressed out and working yourself to death. Your clients actually very much don't benefit, the opposite of benefit. They suffer. And if given the choice, if you had an informed, sophisticated consumer of legal services, you know, when I hire attorneys and accountants and other professionals to work for me, I want to know who they've got helping them. And I'm very wary of hiring a professional who doesn't have any help, because I know that sooner or later that person's going to hit the wall, and it might be while they're working on my matter or my case or my tax strategy or my bookkeeping or my medical records or my whatever. I don't want Superman by himself. I want someone who's got a team around them so that when they stumble, which everyone stumbles, they've got a group of people around them to help them. Your clients benefit when you put a group of people around you and empower them to do the job properly. Number two, but no one can do it as good as me. That's what lawyers love to say. Oh, well, I can't hire an associate because no one's as good as me. I can't hire a paralegal because no one's as good as me. I can't hire a secretary because no one's as good as me. I can't hire someone to answer the phone because it requires a special kind of genius that went to law school to answer the phones, to look at a calendar, to schedule appointments, to return phone calls, and to take messages. Bullshit. Number one, says who? Who says you're the best at anything that you do? Sincerely, who says that you're the best at any of the functions that you perform for your business? That's something to think about. Number two, different and better are not the same thing. You may have your way of doing it, and I may have my way of doing it, and if my way and your way accomplish materially the same outcome, who gives a shit? Your clients don't care. Focus on the outcome. Don't focus so much on the methodology. Just because your paralegal does it one way and you do it a different way, if the outcome is the same, so what? Let him or her do it their way, so long as their way is documented and approved by you. But let them do it their way so that you can focus on doing something that's of higher and better use of your time than being your own paralegal. When we talk about how to calculate the true cost of not hiring staff in a few minutes, I think you'll appreciate the full impact of that message. And last but not least is, so what? So what if you're better than someone else at being a paralegal? Is that really what your business needs? Does the business need you to be doing the job of the world's best paralegal? Or can the business grow better and faster and more profitably with a good enough paralegal and you go out and generate some more business? Third reason why to have a staff is to give others a hand up, not a hand out. Give people an opportunity. All right. Fourth in the outline, how to know when it's time to hire staff. One, or 4A, I should say. As soon as you have a written business plan that calls for the business to employ people. You should have a written business plan. None of you, I hope, would encourage one of your own clients to invest in a business that's being run by someone that doesn't have a written business plan that explains in plain English how is this business actually supposed to work. Hopefully you wouldn't invest in a restaurant or a shoe store or a hotel or a medical office or a dentist office or a retail store or any kind of a business if the owner of the business, no matter, you know, regardless of how smart they are, regardless of how hardworking they are, regardless of how much you trust them, if they can't show you in writing, this is my plan for how the business is actually supposed to function, and you invest in that business, you know what you're going to end up with. You're going to end up with chaos. You end up with a bankruptcy. You probably end up with litigation at some point. You should have a written business plan for your law firm, too. Your law firm is a business. The business plan should address, among other things, the marketing and the sales and the financial controls and the physical plan. Seven main parts of every successful law firm, which, by the way, are also the same seven main parts of every unsuccessful law firm. The difference is the degree to which the operations of each of these seven parts is well thought out, well engineered, written down, and followed. One of them is the people. You've got the following positions on your staff. You should have a written job description for each of the following positions. And I mean a real job description, not something you just find online or pull out of a book. I'm talking about real, plain English. This is what I expect my receptionist to do to make my law firm better. These are the areas of responsibility. These are the day-to-day tasks I expect the job of the receptionist to be in charge of. These are the week-to-week tasks. This is how I'm going to know if the receptionist is doing the job that I want them to do because of these objective metrics and measurables. And make it objective so that when there's a problem, you can be very, very aggressive and hard on the problem without having to beat up on the person. So every law firm has the following positions on staff. Every law firm has a receptionist, a secretary, a paralegal, an associate, a rainmaker, a manager, a CEO, a COO, a CFO, and an owner. The job of the CEO is to see to it that there is a written business plan and that the business plan is being implemented. That's what CEOs of the Am Law 100, that's what the CEOs of big law firms are doing for the big law firms. They're making sure that there's a written business plan and that the business plan is being implemented. A chief operating officer, COO, is there to make sure that there are processes and policies and systems and procedures and checklists and that everything isn't just being done willy-nilly or ad hoc and that everything's being done in a systematic, organized, logical, well-thought-out way. And, of course, the chief financial officer is there to make sure that there's a 12-month forward-looking budget, budget variance reports, cash flow projections, so that the owners of the firm can make forward-looking decisions with confidence to know what's going on in the business. But here, this is primarily we're talking about the chief operating officer job when we talk about creating job descriptions. The job description should describe the job, receptionist, for example, or legal secretary or paralegal or whatever, and it should say this, it should have a list of all the things that position is supposed to be responsible for on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. It should have, ideally, some processes and some checklists that the person can use to self-audit and make sure they're doing the job the way they're supposed to be done, and that you as the owner of the business or the manager of the business can look at and say, let's see if this person is doing the job the way that I specified that they're supposed to do the job. It's like an architect giving a set of blueprints to a builder. If you don't have a set of blueprints and you just say to the builder, build me a house, and they build a house that's not to your liking, you know, who are you going to blame? It's your fault. You didn't give them a set of blueprints. That's what job descriptions are really supposed to be all about. They're just blueprints that show the person how they're supposed to do their job. Too many job descriptions, people pull them off the internet, they find them in books, and they're these vague, ambiguous things that you see on resumes and things like that, and they don't actually take time to explain in plain English, this is how I want you to do the job. This is what I want you to do every day. This is what I want you to do every week. Here are the checklists. Here are the templates. We have an entire four-day workshop that we do annually, and next year we may do it twice because there's so much demand for it, a policy, systems, and procedures workshop. That's not what this teleconference is about, but if that's something that anyone's interested in, the next time you see a promotion for one of our policy, systems, and procedures workshops, it's something you won't want to miss. They're pretty amazing. I don't teach them. One of the members of my team teaches them, which kind of underscores the whole point that we're talking about here. All right, so how to know when it's time to hire staff. One is as soon as your written business plan says, when I reach this point, I need to have these positions on staff in order to get to the next stage. If you don't have a written business plan that anticipates, contemplates, and specifies all of those things out, respectfully, your business plan is a piece of crap and you need to make it better because you're not going to grow your firm. You're going to run into problems. Two, how to know when it's time to hire staff. Two, before you need the help, don't say, please don't do what most lawyers do. Please don't do what most lawyers do. What most lawyers do is they say, well, yeah, you know, that's great that you've got a staff because you've got a multi-million-dollar business. When I got a multi-million-dollar business, I'll get a staff too. As if I would have had a multi-million-dollar business in the first place if I was doing it all by myself. You've got to start hiring staff. Am I saying you got to, like, you know, take out a mortgage on your house and hire 20 people on day one because you know that in 3 years you're going to need 20 people? No, I'm not saying that. But hire one person. Hire two people. Hire someone to take care of the things that are not the highest and best use of your time because you understand that every minute you're doing something that's not the highest, best use of your time, you're not growing your business. Hire people before you need them so you're not hiring from a place of desperation. Been there, done that. I've got the battle scars to prove it. I've waited too long to hire someone, and then I'm desperate, and the first fucking crazy lunatic loser who walks through the door with a pulse, I hire them because I'm desperate. And it never works out well. It always blows up in your face. You never want to be hiring from a place of desperation. So hire before you need the help. Not a year before you need the help, but hire 2 months before you need the help. So you've got time to let someone get trained. So you get to know them. They get to know you. And they can start to break even in about 2 weeks to 3 weeks. And then they can at least pay for themselves until things really start to get busy. Number three, when to hire is when you can see that it's costing you more to not have the help. Write that down. Hire someone when I can see that it's costing me more to not have the help. If you can see that it's costing you a dollar, but you could fix the problem for 50 cents, well, I mean, you don't need to have an MBA to know. The only reasonable, rational, smart, logical thing to do is fix the problem. Which brings us to number five, how to calculate what it's costing you. To do that, you got to, there's four parts. One, you got to have a job description. You got to understand what the job is supposed to be. Good news. You all have the ability to use this high technology. It's high tech. It's called a pen. You could even use a pencil and a piece of paper. And you write down with these things called words what you want the person to do, what you want the job to do. This is all the shit that I would love for someone to take off of my plate. Get very specific. The more specific you can get, the more profitable it will be for you. Two, you look around you and you see what's it going to cost to hire someone to take this off of your plate. So let's say you want to hire someone. Let's say you figure it's going to be $40,000 a year to hire someone to take a particular set of tasks off of your plate. So we do $40,000 a year, and we multiply that times 15%, 1.15, which is what it costs you to really pay someone $40,000. It costs you an extra 15%, so that's $46,000. $46,000 divided by 52 weeks is, look at that, $884 a week. You can hire a $40,000 a year person for only $884 a week. Wow. So for want of $884 a week, for want of, let's call it $1,800, I'm rounding 884 up to $900. $900 times 2 weeks. So for want of $1,800, there are tens of thousands of brilliant, capable lawyers who are never, ever going to reach or come anywhere close to their full potential because they are busy doing the job of a $40,000 a year legal secretary. And all it takes is $1,800, the first 2 weeks salary, plus a plan of action for how this person is supposed to step in and take a bunch of crap off of your plate so that you can do higher, so you can focus on the highest and best uses of your time. So let's suppose you hired this person and you had $1,800 and a job description and a plan of action, and the person stepped in and they gave you 80 hours. It's impossible to conceive that a licensed attorney who is capable of generating upwards of 150, 350, I mean, if we get into the $350 or $500 an hour range, this becomes simply comical and tragic. So let's even just say $150, the low end of the range. It is impossible to conceive that an attorney who is capable of generating $150 an hour, given the attention, given 80 hours of attention from someone, how can you not find a way to bill an extra 30 hours over 2 weeks? So 30 hours times $150 an hour is, look at that, $4,500 minus the $1,800 that it costs you to employ the legal secretary for 2 whole weeks nets you a profit of $2,700 for that 2 week period. Let's just say you did that once a month. Once a month, that's times 12 months, that would be an extra $32,000 of profit for your law firm. Not to mention the better state of mind that you would be in when you're not functioning as your own paralegal or legal secretary or whatnot. And the economics work out the same. The economics are obviously different, but it always turns out to be profitable when you hire someone before you need them against a written job description with proper training so they can make a profit for you. And then the next objection that we always hear is, well, but I have free time. Why should I pay someone $20 an hour to do this when I've got free time? I'll just do it myself. Really? Do you ever have to make apologies to your family that you don't have time to spend with them? Do you ever have to not go to the gym or not exercise or not do something healthy for yourself because you're too busy? What about the value of being rested and fully recovered so that you can be at your best for your clients instead of being at the office late or on the weekends because you're trying to save $20 an hour? And if you really have that kind of free time and you waste it, you squander it, you flush it down the toilet to save $20 an hour, it is flushing it down the toilet, because in those 80 hours that you could buy for only $1,800, 80 hours devoted to marketing, devoted to calling your former clients to see how they're doing, which will trigger repeat business and referrals, 80 hours of meeting with potential referral sources who can refer you tens of thousands of dollars a month, 80 hours of getting yourself booked for speaking engagements and writing articles, 80 hours of anything to generate business for your law firm, and it becomes nothing short of crazy talk to say, if any one of your clients told you this line of thought, you would stop them and say, that's lunacy. That's sheer lunacy. That's self-destructive lunacy. Now, why do lawyers do this? When we're all intelligent people, we can operate a basic calculator. This is simple addition and multiplication and division. There's no complicated math here. Why do lawyers hide out in $20 an hour jobs instead of hiring someone? One reason is because no one ever trained you how to write a job description. No one ever gave you the skills or the tools to actually delegate anything. No one actually helped you think through your processes, your policies, your systems, and your procedures, so you had a framework into which you could insert all of these people who the math clearly demonstrates you should be hiring. Reason number two, no one ever talked you through the math. Just no one ever took you through the math. You just never had a conversation with someone who helped you think this through the way you're now thinking it through. And number three, which is the most common reason, is you don't actually have any kind of a marketing plan. Kind of crazy, right? Why does not having a marketing plan prevent attorneys from hiring staff? What is the connection between not having any kind of a written marketing plan or a written marketing budget or any kind of sales processes or procedures in place? What's the connection between that and an attorney squandering years of his or her valuable time in life doing the job of a $20 an hour legal secretary? And the answer is because if you don't have a marketing plan, you don't know how to make better use of your time. The highest and best use of your time as the owner of your own law firm will always be making sales. Converting prospective clients into paying clients will always be the highest and best use of your time. That's worth thousands of dollars an hour. The second highest and best use of your time is always going to be marketing, because marketing is what brings the prospective clients to the door to be converted into paying clients. That will always be worth thousands of dollars an hour if you do it right. The third highest and best use of your time as the owner of your own law firm is always going to be attending to the financial controls to make sure you're actually getting paid, making sure that bills actually go out, making sure that bills are written in plain English that clients can actually understand the value and they pay them, making sure that you're not going deeper and deeper into the hole with a prospective client month after month and having their accounts receivables growing out of control on you. The fourth highest best use of your time as the owner of your own law firm is not doing the work yourself. It's getting the work done, meaning making sure that the work gets done. And most of the work shouldn't be getting done by you. The original research shouldn't be getting done by you. The scheduling should not be getting done by you. The preliminary drafting should not be getting done by you. The perfunctory hearings shouldn't be getting handled by you. The basic stuff shouldn't be getting done by you. It should be getting done by your staff. Your clients don't benefit when you're wasting your time doing those things. They're not going to be very happy if you charge them $150 an hour to do the job you could hire someone for $20 an hour to do. And you're not going to be fully satisfied in your career. So the reason why lawyers don't hire when they should is because lack of a plan, no policy, systems, and procedures. All right, number six, how to hire. One, we've already alluded to it. I've been pounding on this. Job description, job description, job description. Plain English job description. It doesn't matter if you decide that in your firm, the mail is going to be opened and inventoried and date stamped by the receptionist or by the secretary. It doesn't matter. What does matter is that you make a decision as to if the mail doesn't get handled properly according to your written instructions, are we going to have a conversation with the receptionist, or do we know we need to go have a conversation with the secretary? In other words, you can draw the boundaries anywhere you want. The important thing, though, is you've got to make sure the boundaries are drawn. Okay, but I don't have any staff. It's all me. It's by myself. I said earlier, that's not true. Someone is doing the job of the receptionist. It may be you. You may be the most overqualified receptionist in your city, but if you're answering the phone and there isn't an appointment scheduled on the books to speak to the person who's calling, at that moment, you are demoted from being brilliant lawyer to basic receptionist. If you're doing the job of a receptionist, you're a receptionist. If you're doing the job of a legal secretary, you're a legal secretary. The job is defined by the skills required to do the job, the minimum set of skills required to do the job. The job cannot be defined by the qualifications of the person who happens to be doing the job. You don't need a Juris Doctorate to mow your lawn. You can't say, I need a gardener who went to law school. If you didn't go to law school, you can't be my gardener. The minute you stand behind the lawnmower, unless you're mowing the lawn for relaxation, which I understand some people do, not disparaging that, I'm not one of those people, but some people like to mow their lawn and do yard work for relaxation. And if that's you, this is not meant to apply to you, what I'm saying. Unless you're doing the job for relaxation or for fun, or if you're doing the job to learn the job so that you can document the job, so that you can delegate the job, which is a perfectly valid reason to do a job for a short defined time with an established deadline and an objective criteria for learning it, documenting it, so that you can hire someone else to do it for you. Have job descriptions, real job descriptions. Number two, how to hire. Have job processes. It's not just a job description of these are the tasks, but also you've got to have descriptions. This is how I want this done. This is how I want that done. I prefer it to be left-handed, not right-handed. I prefer it red, not blue. I prefer it spicy, not mild. Whatever your preferences are for how you want things done, you've got to put that in writing so you have a basis against which to train someone and then hold them accountable. And also so that you can give someone the confidence to say to you, look, you said in writing right here you wanted it red, left-handed, and spicy. I gave it to you red. I gave it to you left-handed. I gave it to you spicy. Now step off. You've got to give your team that kind of protection, that kind of armor to protect themselves so that when they do the job the way you've specified you want the job done, they can be confident they're not going to they're not going to get into trouble. How to hire. Last point on how to hire is you hire for profit. You make sure you've engineered the position to make a profit for you. We already gave an example of that where a $40,000 a year position costs you $884 a week for 40 hours a week, including Social Security, unemployment benefits, and things like that. It's still $884 a week. $884 divided by 40 hours is $22.10 an hour. Figure out how the position is going to generate directly more than $22 an hour or indirectly by freeing you up to generate $150. So if I have to pay someone for an hour, $22, and they free me up to be productive for 30 minutes at $150 an hour, I've just made a $50 profit per hour. And of course, if your rate is higher, it's even more obvious the case for that. How to hire. Make a quiz. Make them jump through hoops when they apply for the job. Simple test I like to do when I put out a job description is I'll say in the subject line when you reply to this, when you reply to this ad, put your name spelled backwards in the subject line. I do that for all positions. almost a third of the job of the applications that I get back, I never even bother to look at the application. I don't bother to look at the resume. It goes directly into the trash folder because they can't follow the most basic of instructions to put the name spelled backwards in the subject line. It's a real easy way to screen out the losers. Number two, I require certain formatting for the resume. I'll say, you know, I want it in 12.5-point Courier New font in a PDF. About half of the resumes that we get, they don't follow those instructions. Now, I don't know if they don't follow those instructions because they don't read the instructions, or they don't know how to follow the instructions, or they just don't give a shit to follow the instructions. Either way, this is not a person that I want to waste my time interviewing and then training and then working with only to have the inevitable happen when I discover that they don't follow instructions. Three, when they show up for the interview, don't interview them on their personality. The personality you'll figure out when you're meeting with them well enough. Have a practical quiz ready for them to do. Tell them when you schedule them to come in for the interview, tell them this is going to be a 3-hour interview. We're going to pay you $50 to come in for this 3-hour interview because we are taking 3 hours out of your day. So we're going to pay you for $50 to come in for the interview, and we're going to have some practical exercises for you to do as part of the interview process. Tell them that up front. By the way, be prepared that half the people who you schedule an interview with under those terms will not show up. Guess what? You just ducked a bunch of bullets. Good for you. And, of course, when they do show up and you give them the quiz, you'll find that some people, there's a lot of people who think they're very tech savvy and they're not very tech savvy. There's a lot of people who think they've got great grammar and they don't have good grammar. There's a lot of people who think they're very good at formatting a letter for a professional business letter who really have no idea how to format a professional letter for a business correspondence. Find this out during the interview. Don't ask them. Ask them to show you. Ask them to demonstrate it for you. Last and not least is understand that the first 30 days of the job are still part of the interview process. They're still interviewing for you for the first 30 days. You've got to make sure that's clear in the job offer. And you got to make sure that's clear in your own mind. And this is part of why it's so important not to wait until you're desperate to hire someone, but rather hiring ahead of the curve and ahead of the need, so that if the person is falling apart in their first 30-day interview, in the first 30 days, you don't have to you don't hesitate as much if you have to let them go. And I'm not saying that lightly. No one enjoys, you know, only a sociopath likes firing people. No one likes firing people. But it's a lot better to let someone go in the first 30 days because it's clear that they're not able to do the job against your written, documented, objective job descriptions, policies, and procedures, and checklists, and instructions. And by the way, when you've got those things in writing, that's how you don't lose sleep, because you can say, am I just crazy, or does this instruction not match at all this behavior? If you don't have these instructions, you're constantly second guessing yourself. You're giving people the benefit of the doubt when they shouldn't be getting the benefit of the doubt. You should always give people the benefit of the doubt, but if there's clear instructions that explain how you want the job done, and you've taken the time to train the person on those job descriptions, and they read through the job description, and then there's time for them to talk through the job description with you, and the instructions for how you want things done, and then you give them some practice work to do in the first day that they're there, and then you sit down and you talk them through the practice work to give them constructive feedback. The first 3 or 4 days that you hire a new person, by the way, you are training. You are not letting that person out of your sight. Until you got to the point where your business is large enough that you have other people who are managing and directing your staff for you, in the beginning, certainly until your revenues are $500 to $1 million, you are not letting your new employees out of your sight for the first 2 or 3 days. and you're giving them basically false assignments. You're giving them fake work to do. You're giving them make work. You're giving them these assignments that you planned out ahead of time so that you can test them, so you can see what they're really going to do when you give them assignments to do. So that when you're sitting there analyzing the work that they've done, you're not analyzing the work that they've done and at the same time thinking about all the apologies you need to make because you gave them live ammunition to practice with. Don't give people live ammunition to practice with. Create a training program. And the beauty of it is if you create a training program and it's the same training program for each position, then you have an objective way of learning and saying, wow, you know what? This person is a real dud. How do you know this person is a real dud? Well, I've had three people in the same job. They went through the same training program. The first person picked up on it pretty quick. The second person picked up on it pretty quick. And this person keeps screwing up. You have an objective criteria, building a real business. Last but not least, and then we're going to open the call up for questions and answers, is how to train for profit. This is really simple. It's really, really simple. Lawyers make this complicated. Your staff won't make this complicated, and your employees won't make this complicated. It's only your own inhibitions that make this complicated because you went to law school. And in law school, we were taught to have all kinds of taboos around money. No one else has taboos around money. It's only us that's got taboos around money. Just talk to your prospective new employee when you are interviewing them and have a very candid, open discussion about the fact that I'm going to be paying you $40,000 a year, $50,000 a year, $75,000 a year, $100,000 a year, whatever the number is. And I expect you to produce at least five times that much money in terms of profit for this business. If I'm paying you $50,000 a year, I expect you to produce $250,000 worth of value. Are you okay with that? And most people will surprise you, and they're going to be perfectly okay with that. Anyone who's not okay with that, that is a big clanging red flag, bell, skyrocket, emergency flare, whatever you want to call it. If someone really seems uncomfortable with the notion that you are going to pay them $50,000 a year and you expect them to produce $250,000 worth of value for the business, you know, you better find that out during the interview because that is never going to work out very well for you. It's going to go bad. So ask them right up front. Most people are going to be really okay with that. The smartest people, the really sharp winners, the real winners, the jewels that you will find, will ask you, huh, so does that mean that if I produce $500,000 worth of value that you're going to pay me $100,000? And the answer is yes! That's exactly what you want to say. That's exactly the way you want your people thinking. You want your people thinking that the more value they produce for your business, the more money they can make. And if they're in a position that doesn't produce revenue directly, you want them thinking about how they can produce value in terms of freeing up direct revenue producers to generate more revenue. Okay. Anyone who has not watched the three videos that I shared leading up to this teleconference, I would encourage you to watch those three videos. They were not staged. They were not rehearsed. They were not practiced. They were very raw and authentic and real. And it really is how we operate in how to manage a small law firm. Cursing, door kicking, and casual attire included. We really do practice what we preach. We were an Inc. 5000 company, one of the fastest growing privately held companies in the country. We were awarded that this year, and we already have it on good authority that we'll do it again next year. This is all as a very direct result of two very simple things. One, our growth is a very direct result of the fact, obviously, that we get great results with our members. Our members kick ass, and that's why we keep growing. We wouldn't be growing at this rate if we weren't helping so many solo and small law firms achieve the success that they're achieving. That's obvious. And it's not because of me. It's because of my team. My team is great. There's a difference between an employee and a member of your team. And the term team gets thrown around, but there's really a difference. The difference is if they make more money when you make more money, they're on your team. If they make less money when you make less money, they're on your team. If their income does not go up or down when your income goes up or down, it doesn't have to be in direct one-to-one ratio proportion. But if their income isn't in some way, shape, or form tied to yours, and they know it's tied to yours, and they embrace the idea that it's tied to yours, if your income and their income aren't tied together in some way, shape, or form, they're not on your team. They're just an employee. I'm not saying you can't or shouldn't have just employees sometimes. Sometimes you just want an employee. But if you want to build a multi-million-dollar business, and not everyone on this call aspires to that, and I understand that. I respect that. But if you aspire to have a multi-million-dollar business, you're not going to get there with just employees. You've got to have a team. Plus, it's a lot more fun to go through life that way. All right, so here we go. Now we're going to Q&A.